your fault. Baby, it's not mine. Not chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, be no doubt when you see you are. Rest make dab in the middle of it. Rest make dab in the middle. We are. Rest make dab in the middle of it. Right on schedule.
The Secret Truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. We're going to be covering off the bat this with Mike Cernovich. We're going to be putting up a clip of him explaining what he thinks about, the Epstein suicide that just occurred last night. And we're talking about August the 10th now, so evidently the night of the 9th of August into early morning 10th sometime, they found, Jeffrey Epstein dead, tried to take him out to the hospital, resuscitate him. It didn't work. So as a result, he's pronounced dead, and so he's gone. So Mike Cernovich is very important in this. In the early stages of the investigation in Florida, Mike filed a lawsuit and got involved in the early stages of the first prosecution of Epstein, okay? And so this is very important. And listen carefully what he had to say now about the suicide. Here we go with Mike Cernovich, and then we're going to play a few other files and audio clips of other people's opinion. Here we go with Mike.
Jeffrey Epstein is dead from apparent suicide. This story is bizarre, to say the least. And we're back. Mike Cernovich, Cernovich.com, C-E-R-N-O-V-I-C-H. And the Jeffrey Epstein suicide is peculiar for a number of reasons. One is he had allegedly attempted suicide before in his jail cell, so he was already on suicide watch. So I would like, I would love to hear how somebody who was already on suicide watch from a previous suicide attempt committed suicide. Right? Would really love to hear that. I can already see the headlines now. Cernovich, conspiracy theorist. I would love to hear how someone on suicide watch who had had all shoelaces, belts, sheets, anything that he could make a noose from, how that person was able to commit suicide while in solitary confinement is something I would like to hear your theories about media, right, when the media tries to play this off. This is unbelievably bizarre. This people in solitary confinement who are already on suicide watch, generally speaking, don't commit suicide. It's very, very hard to do, and yet here we are. So what had happened, this has been a long and winding road. Long and winding road. Yesterday, for example, there had been documents released involving Jeffrey Epstein. Documents had been unsealed that implicated him and others. Hold on here, Jeffrey Epstein. Of course, when a massive story happens, that's when the Wi-Fi is going to go down, right? But yesterday, documents had been unsealed and revealed in a case involving Jeffrey Epstein. And these documents contained allegations against a number of people, including Prince Andrew, an unknown member of royalty that people don't know about. And after those documents are released, then somehow, when more could come out, he commits suicide. So Jeffrey Epstein committed suicide while in solitary confinement on suicide watch. That's the story. That's the narrative. This whole story, I mean, I'm reading some mainstream media accounts, and Adam Klass felt very, very mainstream normie. First reaction, there should be hearings as to how this was alleged or how this was allowed to happen to a key witness in an investigation involving global sex trafficking conspiracy. Yeah, Adam, I'm really shocked. I couldn't imagine that a key witness in a global sex trafficking ring would commit suicide. Nobody ever could have seen that happen or foreseen that as happen. So right now, in real time, mainstream media, they're going to have to adjust their operating software. They're going to have to adjust their mental model of the world, right? It doesn't matter how normie mainstream you are. It doesn't matter how credible you think you are. It just does not make sense. I'm sorry. Normie mainstream reporters now are going to have to figure out, how is it that a witness in a criminal sex trafficking ring held in solitary confinement, no rope, strings, belts, binders, sheets, was able to commit suicide? How did this happen? We must hold hearings. Yeah, I'm sure these will be very credible hearings, very searching hearings, and that we will absolutely, we will definitely get answers to these questions, right? I'm sure all of that will. Now, the conspiracy theories, I'm not going to indulge. Some people claim that, you know, he wasn't really. This isn't me claiming it. I don't even want to give fire to it. Other than there's a lot of theories already that this was a secret way to remove him and all this stuff. And, man, I don't know. This is absurd. This is really bizarre that he could be killed in this manner when he's on suicide watch. This is not something that happens to people. So I don't know what really happened. But I do know that it's really bizarre that he was able to kill himself. And this goes to show the scope and the extent that the government will go to. They should have protected him, right? That was their job, to protect him, to find out who else is involved in the sex trafficking ring. But they didn't seem to protect him very well. I'll read some of your comments right now. By the way, if you're on Facebook, like and share this video. Like the video. Give me an emoji reaction. Share it. If you're on YouTube, like and subscribe to my page. Like and subscribe. If you're on Periscope, tap the screen a few times. And, yeah, so someone says, I have worked in jails and it's supposed to be two officers within feet of the suicide watch. Yeah, there's all these rules if someone's on suicide watch. They have to be in a certain position. There have to be multiple people watching them. They have to have all kinds of devices they could use to harm themselves, kept away from them. There's just an incredible amount of rules. Yeah, release the CV tapes. He would be under, that's obvious, right? He would be under surveillance, so let's see the surveillance tapes. I suspect we won't see much of that, though. I doubt we'll get the CV. Why wasn't he, you know? He'd have been under 24-hour surveillance. So I doubt we'll get those videos. I doubt we'll learn much. I doubt this will really go anywhere. To read the files that were unsealed, go to cernovich.com, cernovich.com/Epstein. cernovich.com/Epstein. We have the documents. We have the history of the case. We have all the relevant information that people need. And you can go there and stay updated. I'll be writing about it more. I'll be looking into it more. It's just, I don't know, in my view, this is just too obvious, right? This is just, it's just too obvious. I don't think people are going to find this credible. And a lot of people are going to want to figure out. A lot of people are going to want to figure out what happened. Even I'm seeing just a lot of people, I can't believe this happened. How could this have happened? Good question. Be sure to like and share the video if you're on Facebook. Like and subscribe to the page on YouTube. And if you're on Periscope, share this on Twitter. But yeah, Jeffrey Epstein's dead. He committed suicide while he's on suicide watch in a room all by himself under 24/7 surveillance with multiple guards monitoring him. And he had no ropes, strings, or sheets, but he was able to commit suicide. This is the most effective Houdini suicide artist in world history.
Coming up next, we've got Trey Gowdy, and he's saying what he believes could happen, and there are accessories possibly to Epstein's pedophilia violation, possible violations, that could still be prosecuted, and I believe there's civil suits that are ongoing for money, big money suits. So those two are the angles. But let's listen to what Trey Gowdy has to say right now.
What happens now after the apparent death by suicide of Jeffrey Epstein, the 66-year-old billionaire who palled around with some very powerful people? What happens now in an investigation that looked like it was getting some promising results early on? The former House Oversight Committee chairman, former Republican South Carolina congressman, Trey Gowdy with us now. Congressman, what do you think? Where does this case go now?
Well, the case against him is over, but to the extent there are others who aided and abetted or had knowledge of these crimes and a duty to report and failed to do so, if there is sufficient factual predicate, they can still be charged. I am heartbroken only for the victims who were denied an opportunity to see their attacker in a very different position in court. He's not in control. He's not in power. He's not calling the shots. He's in court in a jumpsuit and handcuffs. And for a lot of victims, that final image provides closure to the extent you can have it. So I'm sorry for them, but he wasn't going to testify against others, I don't think. I certainly would not give him a cut in time to go implicate people who may have been less culpable. That makes no sense in the criminal justice system. I will say this, Neil. You can't get the death penalty for anything other than taking another life. But most Americans think you ought to be able to get it for committing a sex assault on a child. The Supreme Court disagrees, but most Americans, if we were to have a hierarchy of crimes, crimes against children, including sexual crimes against children, would be right up there near the top of it. So I'm glad he's dead, but I'm sorry for the victims that they are denied an opportunity to see him in a different light.
You know, he was under the suicide watch, Congressman. A lot of people are still scratching their heads how he could have committed suicide in the first place. Assuming he was under 24/7 surveillance, either in person or via a security cam, how could that happen?
Well, some of us are still scratching our heads at how Jack Ruby could shoot Lee Harvey Oswald. And I think may have been at a police station, wasn't it? So, look, we're 2 hours in. I'm a big believer in gathering the facts first, and then you can draw whatever conclusions you want from the facts. The videotape doesn't lie. It doesn't forget. So to the extent that there's video monitoring, talk to the guards. Particularly criminals, particularly high-end criminals, are very creative when it comes to either escaping, taking their own life. That's how they've evaded capture thus far, is they are creative. So I'm going to withhold judgment until I know exactly how it happened and who allowed it to happen.
That's a great concept there, Congressman. Thank you very, very much.
Yes, sir. Thank
Trey
you.
Trey Gowdy.
Now, that pretty good. Trey Gowdy, pretty level-headed guy. He has prosecution experience also. Coming up next is Tony Schaefer to bring us up a little bit of his perspective. He's a pretty much of a moderate on many of these items and topics that are ongoing right now. But also, what he has to say is it can be counted on. Tony Schaefer, Colonel Tony Schaefer, is going to express his views about some of these rulings that have just occurred, and the Inspector General, some of his criminal referrals, and he makes a statement about James Comey. So here we go with Colonel Schaefer. Here we go now.
Tony Schaefer, wonderful to have you back again on American Thought
thank
Leaders.
You. Good to be here again. Good to be here in the greatest city on earth, New York.
Absolutely.
Thank you for coming up and talking to me again.
You know, it's wonderful. And, I mean, we talked last May. I think this was around the time when the Attorney General Barr, he had just gotten his mandate, I think.
Right.
And, you know, we were doing a bit of speculation about where things could go, what he should investigate.
Mm-hmm.
So where have things gone since? What are you aware of?
The IG report, I think, is helping to shape a lot of the Attorney General's thinking about what to do next. There has been credible reporting, that criminal referrals were issued for leaking of classified information by a number of people, to include a guy named Jim Comey, which they deferred to prosecute. That is to say that the IG recommended prosecution. It went to Department of Justice, and then Barr decided not to prosecute. Now, a lot of people were upset about that.
Yes.
I'm not, because I think there's more to come to the point.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of that information that they're receiving is now going to the criminal side for additional investigation. You don't want to go after someone for something minor if you think they've actually done something major. It's like grabbing someone for, moping with intent to loiter. Okay. Versus someone who did a murder, and you want to go get him for that. You know, you don't want to charge him prematurely before you get all the evidence. So I think that's what's going on. The second piece of this has been, I think, missed to the general public, but equally important. As you review the foreign counterintelligence operations that were ongoing during the period of 15, 16, and into 17, there's two factors you have to examine first. Some of these operations were probably legitimate foreign counterintelligence operations. That is to say that they're, despite the drama we've seen, there were actually spies attempting to suborn U.S. citizens to steal information. So anything that is a legitimate sanctioned operation that should be focused on preventing the loss of technology, critical information, or access to individuals with access to the U.S. government, those are legitimate operations that should be maintained. Separate from that, as we've seen with Massoud, with Papadopoulos and others, there's the appearance that the very foundation of foreign counterintelligence operations were essentially not justifiable. As a matter of fact, not a single Russian was involved. So it's hard to justify an operation where you're attempting to indict people or entice people to have contact with the Russians if there's no Russians involved. So that's the thing. You have to have establish legitimate operations, maintain those, and separate out those surgically that were either illegal or ill thought or otherwise compromised from the beginning. The bottom line is no one wants to compromise real U.S. national security at the same time, but we have constitutional requirements for accountability, and that's, I think, what Barr is trying to sort through right now.
Coming up next, we've got a very, very good interview that Alex Jones had with Jim Baker. And Jim Baker is a very exceptional person in the sense that he headed up three states for Trump during the run-up to the election to try to secure three primaries. And he tells us what he was up against with his Quincy Institute that was financed by the Koch brothers and by Soros, okay? So anyway, listen to this. This is a very, very good explanation of some of the background politics. And evidently, the Koch brothers, of course, Soros, are lined up against Trump. And they're supporting the Democratic candidate. So here we go with Alex Jones and Jim Baker. Here we go right now.
Aware of some of the work he'd done. He's a political operative historian. We should get on as a guest about that, who served in various roles in a number of campaigns during 2016 primaries and caucuses. He served as President Trump's state director for Kansas, Colorado, and Illinois. And he was there witnessing all the dirty tricks of Ted Cruz, who I still like, but man, he got dirty when the cards were down. So not going to turn my back on him. He witnessed the Koch brothers and these globalist interests that are in there. So he can give you a bird's eye view. Thanks for coming on with us. Sorry I moved you back 30 minutes. I'm behind today. We appreciate your time.
That's all right. Thanks for having me, Alex. Love your show. Love your work, Joe Biggs. We actually met I think in the Colorado State Capitol at that Stop the Steal rally we did to kind of work against that hijacking of the process they did in the Colorado caucus.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, so I started with Trump in Iowa. I'm an Iowa resident. I've worked in Iowa politics for a long time. And, you know, we had a good team in Iowa and had things going pretty well. It actually looked like we were going to win. And then all of a sudden, about, I don't know, 2-3 weeks out from the actual caucus date, we got this flooding of AFP operatives, so Americans for Prosperity, which would be the Koch brothers' main apparatus. And I just remember the minute they got there, everything kind of changed. And we all kind of sensed that they were might be tanking the operation a little bit. I don't know if you remember, we had a debate scheduled. And as soon as they got there, they decided they weren't going to do this Fox News debate, which, yeah, we knew Megyn Kelly wasn't being fair. But at the end of the day, we knew that was really going to hurt our Iowa operation. Not to mention that, but they just started cussing and drinking in the office. And we had these Midwestern sweet volunteers. And it just turned everybody off. Anyway, so we lost to Iowa. I came in third place. And then, like I said, I went to Kansas. I wasn't given any staff. I wasn't given any office. I ran out of a hotel suite in Topeka. You could just tell once the AFP guys got in there that they were leaving us alone when it looked like Trump didn't have a chance. But then once we actually got some momentum.
Traction.
Yeah. You could tell that they kind of jumped in. And
the reason you're important is you ended up heading up three major states. I remember seeing you on the news. I know who you are. I mean, you're a real player in this, and you're giving us the inside window to what happened. You can give us a really good forecast on what's going to come.
Yeah. So I basically retired after 2016, went into the private sector. Just the hate and the vitriol and what some of the AFP people tried to do to me after I left the Trump campaign. I actually went and ran an independent campaign up in upstate New York. I just got more into, you know, studying the Bible and being with my family and just kind of cleansed my soul of politics. But now seeing what's going on now with gun control and with this transgender stuff and the attacks on our kids, I just can't sit idly by. The Lord's told me I needed to talk to you. That's why I called in the other day. But, I mean, if you look at the Koch brothers, a lot of people consider them to be our version, the conservative version.
No, but Tucker's right. They're not.
No, they're not. And if you look. If you go to AFP's website, I think it's still up, they have a petition for the Senate Judiciary Committee that says don't enact any antitrust laws against big tech. I mean, their top guy, Jesse Blumenthal, I think his name is, who runs their tech and innovation wing at AFP, has said there's no credible evidence of conservative censorship online. Do you see that, Alex?
And so, no, exactly. So what you're saying is the Koch brothers and this AFP are the enemy. How do we stop them?
So what I want to say to President Trump, if I could talk to him directly, I would say you're still hiring from the swamp. So the way these AFP guys work, and almost every Republican operative works on a campaign for a little while, and then the campaign's over, they win, they lose, whatever. But in the off season, they go to work for AFP. And as the Bible says in the book of James, a double-minded person is unstable in all his ways. So these people have dual allegiances, or sometimes just an allegiance to the Koch brothers, and they're still working for Trump. There's something like 44 Koch operatives in the Trump White House or in the Trump administration. So for this reelection campaign, I tell Trump, if you want to hire somebody, hire people out of business. You're a businessman. Hire salespeople. You don't need
exactly. And again, the Kochs didn't give any money to Trump, and he doesn't know all this. He needs to throw their asses out.
They already said 2 months ago, they said, it's in Breitbart, I think it was on InfoWars, a bunch of different places, they're supporting Democrats in 2020. Okay? They're open borders.
No, that's right. It was a New York Times article like, the Koch brothers are really good, and they're supporting Democrats now.
If your listeners want to look up this Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, David Koch, I think, put in $500 million. George Soros put in $500 million, and they named an Iranian-American who's very anti-Israel, loves Ilhan Omar, to run this Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft.
Stop right there. See how bombshell this is? And the numbers are all there. I've seen this. The Koch brothers were always Democrats. They were the second biggest donor to the Clintons after Tyson Chicken. And then they come in to control Republicans. And then the left always says, I work for the Koch brothers. Absolute asinine lies. And now they're teamed up, the Koch brothers, with George Soros, to defeat Donald Trump, and Trump doesn't even know he's got people in the Oval Office sharpening knives for him.
Jim Baker said some very important things there, and I'm just going to reiterate this Quincy Institute. Look into that. I have a click off up on thesecrettruth.com. Anyway, Charlotte Littlefield Brown and I have been broadcasting since 2006, November 1. It'll be 13 years this coming November 1st, 2019. And we've got a plethora of differing interviews over those almost 13 years. But what's important is that we're beginning to be able to pick up jewels of interviews from a lot of different programming across the web, see. And by doing that, then we're being able to really cover a lot more issues and topics very quickly. We are going to be getting back, instead of replaying our second hour, we'll probably be getting back to a book interview, and maybe the first hour may be what we're doing with clips and contemporary news and so forth. But you can find us at thesecrettruth.com on the internet, and we put the program up after 6 o'clock every Saturday evening, and I believe it's live streamed from Texas Liberty Radio from 7 to 9. But anyway, try to pick us up on that if you can. There are other topics out there and issues. On this El Paso shooting that just occurred last Saturday, there are eyewitnesses to a multiple shooting scenario. Now, it's typical in these types of mass shootings where that is never admitted to. And there were early reports, if you'll remember. I was watching last Saturday. I was watching the reports coming in from El Paso on live video feeds from the stations there that were doing the reporting. And so television reports coming in live, and they had cameras out there at the Walmart that the shooting occurred at, said that there were multiple shootings. There was people interviewed, individuals inside, customers that were corralled back into some of the storage bins back there, and containers, and sheltered for a while. Some of those reports said that there were shooting in different places inside. We have several witnesses on the web that say there was shooting. That one witness standing in line with her family said there were four men in black with masks on that came through the front door and started shooting into the crowds and stuff for it. There's another eyewitness early on outside, a woman that was in her car with her mother and family, and she saw this man in black. He was not masked, walk into the Walmart, but before he walked in, she said on live radio television there that he shot three or four women out in the parking lot that were trying to get their goods, their purchased items back to their car. And then he went in. Now, what's really suspicious about some of this, and there's questions on any of these mass shooters episodes, these events, we usually come up with a large number, I can't say a large number, but a number of inconsistencies and questions that no one is able to answer like they should. We have snapshots of from the video of the so-called shooter coming through the front door. He does not have a t-shirt on, an undershirt on. Also, what Mike Adams pointed out on his site just recently in the last few days was the weapon that he had, Ms. Cruces had, was a AK-47 with a gun, you could say, stock, a gun grip stock. And the banana clip that goes in these holes, I think, 30 rounds. He had one in the gun, but nowhere in the video or the actual snapshot are we able to discern. These clips are real long, and they're in the shape of a banana. They're curved. But nowhere in his pockets do we see large enough, a vest or something like that, that you would need to carry two or three or four more that he would have to carry out the number of shots and to kill the number of people inside the Walmart that he did. So there's a big question mark there. Now, we have video of the so-called shooter standing outside. It almost looks in a leisurely way. And they stopped him in a car, got him out, and he admitted, "I'm the shooter," you know, and they put him out on the street corner or something. But that man has a white T-shirt on underneath his black shirt. And if that had just occurred, then there would be not enough time to put a T-shirt on underneath the black shirt. So, and then we have his family. He's got, his father has had evidently problems in the past. And with some kind of psychological treatment that sounds, it's pretty far out, you know. It's very unusual treatment that his father's come up with. So we have that going on at this time. So there's just, you know, one thing after another. The shooting that occurred in Douglas High, for example, this is just another example of an inconsistency, in Douglas High in Lakeland there, Florida. That shooting had four men coming out of the end of the building that the shooting occurred in. They two men loaded a very heavy bag into the back of a white pickup, unmarked, but with red and blue flashing lights on the front of the white pickup. And then four men loaded in, and then one man in a uniform, a police uniform, along with a driver, drove off. Just about 35, 45 minutes after the shooting occurred, they were still evacuating students at the next door, right across the sidewalk from the shooting building and the building that the shooting occurred in. So we have that from a CBS helicopter that got up pretty fast. And it's never been answered who that was and what they were doing in that building. Then we have these multiple reports coming from individuals. Then right here lately, I've been scanning some of the news, and I think CBS is carrying a story that that were inaccurate. Multiple shooters at that Walmart shooting were inaccurate. But some of the first reports that we heard said that there were multiple shooters. Now, earlier on in this hour, we played some Jeffrey Epstein. Just a few days ago, last week, it was reported that he had attempted some kind of a suicide, or someone said maybe someone attempted to kill him or something, I don't know. But they put him on suicide watch. And did they take him off of that in the last day or two or what? So this is reaching the very, very top level of your world system, of the top rulers in the world. And they tied him in the court and in the charges to pedophilia of very young girls he had introduced to these older men. And there was one as young as 14. And most of them, I think, were around 16 to 18 or whatever. But he was, you know, introducing and going to the island down there that he owns, he was enticing young girls to come in and have sex with some of these older men. Now, we go back in history, though, to these kinds of appetites by these men, older men. We go back to the Omaha, Nebraska. John DeCamp wrote a book called Franklin Cover-Up. And in that book, he was a state representative, a state senator, I think, at the time. They uncovered some pedophilia going on out of Omaha, Nebraska. And then it was all shut down, you know, and you could say covered up. But he did a fine book on that Franklin cover-up. And the Franklin cover-up name came about from a savings and loan that went broke during the big debacle in the savings and loan businesses. Savings and banks went broke. And so I believe that's what it was named after. But we go from there, we go to all kinds of subsequent events. We have, you know, accusations that came out of that that spilled over to the D.C. madam. I had a man that I interviewed not long ago, and you can go to our site, thesecrettruth.com, and replay the interview that I had. He ran a call service of young men, not under the age, but young men in their 20s, adults, to politicos, Pentagon officials, and so forth. And I believe he was working with Craig Spence at the time. And Craig Spence was evidently tied into maybe the CIA or some really high-level intelligence service. We don't actually have absolute proof on some of this because you're getting up into the higher echelon of the power pyramid, see. And so this is where you're going to lose some direct evidence because these people, like Jeffrey Epstein, they end up, you know, suiciding themselves, suicide, or we call it being suicided, you know, by the powers that are, see. But we don't know, you know, in his jail cell, you know, in solitary, I mean, by himself, and he ends up, you know, previously on suicide watch, and then all of a sudden, you know, he comes up with suicide. That's very, very suspicious. Very suspicious. This multiple shooting thing in El Paso has never been answered properly either. But we'll just see. Normally, they'll just pin it on one person. Now, this other stuff that came up with Jim Baker on Alex's show about the Koch brothers and Quincy Institute, let's look at that. Because they are for open borders, and that Quincy Institute is not saying that your social network companies are biased against the conservative right, but they are. So if they're making those kinds of statements like that, then they're totally off the wall with their views. Just want to end the program with a little bit of history about money, okay? And I usually call it money sorcery, okay? But what I'd like to do is go back in time and just describe a little bit about how this money situation, I'm not going to go past the goldsmiths in the 1600s in London, but we're going to go back to at least that, okay? And what was going on was there were goldsmiths in London that were fabricating just beautiful jewelry for the well-to-do and the very rich in London. And so they had the most security on their strong rooms. They had strong rooms that these goldsmiths kept their gold in. And so it got around that those were very, very secure rooms, guarded day and night, and no one, you know, could get in there and rob them. You know, they had guards day and night. So the very wealthy people began to work with the goldsmiths. The goldsmiths needed gold anyway, but the very well-to-do took their gold and started storing it in these goldsmiths' strong rooms. Well, the goldsmiths would give to the rich people a receipt for that gold that was being stored. And they charged them fees for the storage of that. Well, it got to be where the receipts were beginning to be traded around, okay? So instead of a really rich person going down and getting the gold, taking the gold to buy something, he would just take the receipt and give the receipt to someone that he wanted to buy something from, a real estate piece of property or whatever. So it got to be where nobody went down and redeemed their gold. So the goldsmiths began to say, oh, yeah. So they started issuing more receipts than they had gold, see. And that's basically, you could say, the way the banks work today, see. But the creation, see, of credit is what we're talking about on a set of books, okay? The goldsmiths were saying, But we hereby give you this receipt for so many ounces of gold, and you can redeem it at any time, you know, and, you know, by the presentation of this receipt. Well, the few people that did redeem their receipts for gold got their gold. But there was way, way more receipts than there was gold. So the goldsmiths had created then, had created from out of thin air credit in the form of a piece of paper. And that's really the secret of your banking system today. People were asking me one time at a meeting that we were having, you know, this thing about creating money out of thin air, you know, we were talking about that, and I went home. We always heard that, you know, all the time about the way money is created out of thin air, and we knew that it was on a set of books, banker's books, say. But I went home, and I came back to the meeting the next week. That was a weekly meeting at the time. And I said, no, the money is not created from out of thin air. You know, it's created all right on the set of books. But I would conjecture that it's created from out of the space-time continuum. See, going way back, especially in the 1700s, you had Rousseau that was quite a writer, a French writer. And he came up with many, many ways to make men equal, very idealistic in his writings. Who followed him were some people that wanted to institute some of those into political realities, see? And you could say they were some of the first socialist, communist, communitarians in Paris, see? And so as a result, you had a movement beginning there in Paris. And then you had a branch, a breakoff from that Paris group that ended up in Frankfurt, okay? Society of the Just. And it's very intriguing, but that occurred later. These French writers actually coined the term communism early on. And there were experiments in Paris at one time. But so that was a movement, you know, but that began in France. But you had other movements counter to that that would be revolutionary nationalism. Or you could say revolutionary communism, see. Those are two of the main movements occurring in the 1700s on into present time. Now, what actually evolved is that was right around the Industrial Revolution that was beginning also. So the Industrial Revolution lent itself to a capitalistic system and a banking system. The Bank of England, the East India Company, was founded in 1600, and it was generating tremendous, vast sums of profit from the opium dealing into China and the spices in returning back to Western Europe, to UK, you know, Western Europe and England. So there were vast fortunes being made there. So a little later on, though, you had this movement in France first came the American Revolution, and after that came the French Revolution. But those basic revolutions were a little bit different in scope and in beginnings. The American Revolution was based upon more of a natural law idea, okay, but not a communistic, socialistic idea. It was much more of a republic protecting individuals' freedoms and rights above a community or a group's rights, see. It was sort of protecting the individual from the group or from the government or from the communitarian gang, you could say, or the gang of the tyranny of the majority that Tocqueville spoke about, where fear democracy, the majority rules. So he called that the tyranny of the majority, see. But what you had these two movements. You could say the revolutionary nationalism movement, and then you had the revolutionary communist movement. Later on, the revolutionary communist movement would be seized owned by Marx and Engels. And they would, when the Industrial Revolution began, then there was a rise of unionism and labor organizing, see? And so out of the labor organizing, Marx and Engels saw that as a way to politically work their communism and their socialism into the new movement to take over and dominate. On the other hand, you had the revolutionary nationalists, which were supported by the capitalists, you could say, who begin to see in England especially a danger to that capital base, to that wealth. They were some of the earlier bankers there, 1694, 96, I think, was the Bank of England. So they began to found a movement based upon revolutionary nationalism, but they wanted to gain power over the throne. See, both movements were a danger to the monarchical system of kings and queens. So instead of taking out the kings and queens totally in England, all they did was co-opt them into the money power that they were building. And the money power base was established in London with stock trading and bond trading and banking and so forth. And that was further accelerated by the move of the Rothschilds from the Frankfurt area into London with some German princes, just ultra wealthy money. And that accelerated this whole money power system. The British began to see that, these masses, these peasants, when they begin to make some money and they become a middle class, they're a danger to our control system, to our rule. So we're going to create something like the Fabian Society as a controlled opposition. First, we're going to put these poor laws out there and we're going to make everyone subservient to the government and fit into a certain cubicle, see. A certain, you could say pigeonhole to where they were limited, see. So, but we're going to secretly, you could say, fund this opposition left, which has become the socialist communist left. But we're going to hang on to our dominance of the money system. So the short little saying that I came up with years ago was physical superiority orchestrating money, hype, and mind sorcery. So what we have is the people that are in control in this world today, right today, not back then, not the 1700s, 1800s, 1900s, right today, they dominate and control the militaries of our nations and the nuclear and the highest, you could say, most advanced weapon systems. That's their physical superiority over their enemies. The other two things was money, mind sorcery. The money sorcery was controlling the central banks and creating credits on a set of books from out of nowhere. I say it's from out of the space-time continuum. Then everything is dominated in that space-time continuum. The mind sorcery is a little bit different. It's a little bit different to explain. A little bit more difficult to explain. Early on, we had the rise of the Catholic Church coming in out of Rome, and of course you had the schism there that developed. But you had the churches that began to consolidate their power. Say. So a system of thought, an ism, Christianity or what Catholicism or whatever, became a way to dominate people and to extract money from them by tithes, you know. At 10%, the Bible says that, so you better give it, see. If you don't, then bad things are going to happen to you, see. And then, but it's a way to socialize and so forth. The money powers were already dominating through a system of usury, see. Now, Jesus Christ ran the money changers out of the temple because of excessive charging for changing the money into type of money that the Jews would accept in their churches there. So the money itself is a means by which to support what is wrong in us. What is wrong in every man is a false self, an ego state. Men suffer in this state more than women. And so a system of money and was devised called so-called capitalism. But the problem with the form that we have is crony capitalism, where the creation of these credits on a set of books is monopoly. And that's what makes it crony capitalism. What's in opposition to this crony capitalism, but they don't see the crony, is an idealistic system of socialism, communism, Marxism. All men are equal, and so forth. But the problem with that is that it's not in conformity or compatibility, I guess would be the word, with human nature, see. The reason why capitalism was successful and continues to be successful, I still support that as the most efficient system because it takes care of selfish needs, okay, and desires. The socialism thing sounds good, but it doesn't provide equal work it doesn't distribute the labor load properly. See, some people will work and others won't. And so you have an unfair system with that. Now getting back to what's going on today is that these two systems are supposedly battling one another. But the banker, through the ownership of the central banks and the dominance of the major corporations, and now the social network corporations and so forth, are dominating, you could say, the propaganda, the mind sorcery, the money sorcery, and they own the superior force, you could say. So what we're seeing now is that we're seeing a rise, okay, in the left, but that is being financed, you could say, by the capitalist, ultra-capitalist on the right. Now, the ultra-capitalists on the right are only funding the world communist movement to create a world plantation system. And that's really what we're looking at now, is people don't really ever see or wake up to this, to what it really is. And what it is that they're going back to a middle age system, okay, of dumbing people down with food, medicines, propaganda, religion, everything else that goes with all that, and then bringing them into a world system, see, that is money dominates still, but by more of a fascist, corporate fascist type of thing, where the major corporations now are pushing, partnerships, public-private partnerships, with the central governments. But then they come and to dominate, they come to dominate. It's just like a big corporate chief will fly in on his corporate jet, and one of your politicals might fly in on some commercial, ticket, see. So the corporate people have become so big and ultra wealthy that they're beginning to collaborate. Whether they're collaborating with China or whatever, they're internationalists. They're transnationalists. Internationalists, see. That's where you have this globalism thing that is reared its ugly head. And this is where Trump and the globalist part company is that Trump is at least trying. He doesn't come across with some good foreign relations all the time, but he is trying to, I think he loves the country deep down. He's patriotic, but he's also trying to bring America back to not succumb to world dominance by these Chinese and their globalist partners. That's really what's happening, is that the globalists working out of Western Europe and the biggest banking and business centers in the world have struck a deal with the Chinese. It's amazing that what Trump is beginning to break up this partnership and is beginning to attract some of those people that have misgivings now about partnering with the Chinese. They should have never partnered with the Chinese, and they should have stayed loyal to the Western banking and financial and corporate, you could say, block, okay? But right now, we've got these, the America then now, is these extreme leftist groups are being funded indirectly by this corporate money. And that's causing great division and harm to our country. Plus, the ideas that are coming out now called white nationalism, white supremacies, and all that, is they're not accurately depicting what is happening in America today. So, but it, and it's unsettling and it's upsetting to a lot of people, see. So we've got to start awakening, you could say, to a better state of being, you could say, than what we've had before. And to come out of it is where you have to begin to forgive and forget and begin to perceive this world system like it is, like it really is. And if you can really begin to see this world system like it is, the way I've been viewing it over, you'll be able to awaken from that, you could say, slave state, see, of hating, resenting, jealous of, striving for money, to puff your own ego and false self, and I'm better than they are, they're no good, and my group is okay, that group is not. It's all cult thinking a lot of times. But it undoes us. It defeats us. It's self-defeating. It's self, you could say, delusionary. We're self-deluding ourselves into thinking that we're greater than we really are, see. Because the money acts in a manner to puff, to grow, see, to expand, to make immense in scope, the idea of who we think we are. But that idea of who we think we are is only temporal. It's not lasting. This life, these lives that we lead in this world and on the earth, this blue planet, you could say, seen from space as a blue planet because of the water, it's just a wink in the eye of God. So what we must do is awaken to and come out of that deluded state and try to attain a higher state of being, of seeing this ourselves as we really are. I want to thank everyone for listening tonight, and we have a lot of troubles in this world and in this country. We must begin to love our neighbors and speak with them about these problems that we have. Instead of calling each other names and cussing and all that, let's extend a hand. Let's quit this division and hatred and resentment. And let's stretch a hand across the aisle, Democrats, Republicans, and start addressing some of the real problems that we have in this country and America. But it's dangerous out there. So I hope and pray that this world will be a better place. And especially I pray very deeply for America. And thank God, I hope it will work worldwide. Thank you and good night.